Williams versus Petrade International Incorporated.
May it please the court, Mr. Matthew Carl and the Honorable Robert M. Campbell will present argument for the petition. Mr. McFarland, will you?
May it please the court, this case arises from a series of contract claims. The proposed transaction was an A to B to C sale of petroleum products. A was Gulf States, B was Petrade, C is Adams Box. The entire transaction occurred in 2 months in 1979. On July 30, 1979, Petrade sued Gulf States. Later, Petrade sued Adams Box. Gulf States, Petrade obtained a judgment at trial against Adams Box. Today, we ask you to reverse the case for three reasons. One, the satisfaction rule. An injured party is entitled to but one satisfaction of his injury. We ask the court to reverse as well because the Mary Carter agreement in this case was so prejudicial, it denied Adams and Box a fair trial. We ask the court to reverse for the reason that a person who contributes to an injury may not accept an assignment of that very cause of action and prosecute it himself. If you'll turn to page 4 of the outline, I have a blown up copy of that page and I will show the court the one recovery aspect of this case. Petrade, represented by this block in the middle, filed its suit July 30, 1979 against Gulf States. It sought what has been called by the Court of Appeals a $3.6 million advance payment that Petrade made on the purchase of two oil. Gulf States answered, denied Petrade was entitled to recover a title to delivery. In 1981, Gulf States' counterclaim against Petrade was asserted a $4.4 million claim for breach of two gasoline contracts. In its pleading, it said that it wanted $4.4 million, I'll jump ahead just for a second. At trial, Gulf States representative testified that that contract, that claim, was worth $4.4 million. But in its pleading, asserted in 1981, it says that it gives Petrade credit for the $3.6 million in advance payment on the oil contract, and after having given that credit, it's entitled to $1.9 million over it. Now, 3 days before the second anniversary of the filing of the suit against Gulf States, Petrade sued Adams Box. It alleges a number of theories. It sued for breach of the oil contract, or alternatively for breach of the settlement contract that was added later. I'll get to that. It sued for the oil contract and two gasoline contracts, represented by these entries. 4.5 years after the transaction, after suit had been filed, in December of 1983, a new claim is added. This claim is for breach of a settlement agreement between Adams and Petrade. It's a suit on a unsigned, we suggest a draft sent by Mr. Adams' lawyer to Petrade. It was to settle the fuel oil claim. In January of 1986, on the second day, Gulf States and Petrade revealed the existence of their Mary Carter agreement. This was 20 days before trial. It was substantially after the November 11 cutoff of discovery, pleadings, and parties. In fact, both Petrade and Gulf States had answered interrogatories in August of 1985, saying, or interrogatories which asked if there were any settlement agreements, any agreements concerning trial, any agreements of any nature between any party to this lawsuit, and the answers were negative. So here we are, 20 days before trial, we're faced with the Mary Carter Agreement, which works a substantial realignment of the parties. Gulf States moved from being a defendant who for 7 years has denied that Petrade was entitled to delivery of this petroleum product, a defense that Mr. Adams, of course, asserted that since Petrade wasn't entitled or didn't have the product to deliver, they couldn't perform. So that defense was taken away from Mr. Adams and Mr. Box shortly before the trial. A judgment was procured. The three reasons we ask the court again are to reverse are one satisfaction and only one satisfaction. The Mary Carter Agreement was prejudicial, and that what was affected by this Mary Carter Agreement was an assignment of the interest in the cause of action that Petrade had to Gulf States. Let me briefly argue, please, the one satisfaction. The Court of Appeals has said that this does not apply in a contract case. It has said that you look to the wrong, not to the injury. And it has said, finally, that this is not one injury. We suggest that the pleadings, the evidence at trial shows that Petrade received satisfaction of its $3.6 million payment. In fact, it received more than that. It got out of a claim that its co-plaintiff said was worth $4.4 million. So it doesn't matter that it hasn't received money. It's received a release from an obligation.
It had it just cut its losses. It's still out $3.6 million in cash. How can you make money by not being charged an extra $4.4 million?
If you have a claim against you, a debt against you that's $4.4 million, then you have...
On top of the 3.6.
Yes, Your Honor. The 3.6 was an advance payment for the two fuel oil. The counterclaim by Gulf States was for $4.4 million on two gasoline contracts.
So your total negative from the entire transaction is potentially $8 million.
Or more.
Or more. And you're only out 3.6. Now how can you say that your damages have been satisfied if you just cut your losses from 8 to 3.6?
Well, if we had caused the loss, that would be the way to look at it. We didn't.
Adams didn't cause the loss?
No. Now, in the petition filed initially by Petrate against Gulf State. It says it wants the $3.6 million advance payment back and $1 million consequential damages. In the pleadings, it alleges that it was prevented from delivering the product to Mr. Adams and Mr. Bobbins. So it's received received forgiveness of the 4.4 against its claim for $3.6 million advance and its claim for consequential damages. We pled that we were entitled to a credit in the value of whatever they received in settlement. We offered into evidence the pleadings. We obtained the trial testimony of the co-plaintiff that the claim that they forgave was worth $4.4 million. We submitted a special issue. We made a post-trial motion. The error is preserved.
But how can the efforts of Petrate and Gulf States to resolve among themselves their own differences and in effect cut their loss be a credit to Adams, who allegedly caused all the loss in the first place by not taking the gasoline and not fulfilling the settlement agreement?
Your Honor, if the same injury, regardless of the theories of causation, if the same injury has been satisfied, you're only entitled to one satisfaction. That's the answer. There is only one satisfaction. You can call it deceptive trade, conversion, breach of contract, or whatever you will. There was only one. Now, it's true they asked for other, perhaps I can, I'm not sure I understand the court's question, but it's true that they asked for other recoveries at the time of trial. They asked for millions of dollars in the various theories.
Let me put it very simply. Petrate is out something. Gulf States is out something. Adams is out nothing. How can Adams get a credit by two other parties being out?
If the damage that Adams purportedly caused has been satisfied, he gets a credit.
How can it be satisfied if both the other parties that are allegedly damaged are out some amount of money?
Well, Adams is not concerned with Gulf State. Adams is concerned with the person claimed against it. The only cause of action is Petrate's cause of action. Petrate's cause of action, the only damages that it got through trial election and through the opinion of the Court of Appeals, is the reliance, the 3.6, it's been trimmed down, but that was their only damages, is the 3.6 million. Now, setting Gulf States aside, it's just between Petrate's cause of action, J.R. Adams, the cause of action for 3.6 million was satisfied. In fact, it was satisfied, we say, as a matter of law. It was in excess of the claim that they made against Adams Box. The Mary Carter agreement didn't include a mere covenant not to sue. It in fact was a complete release of each of the parties to the agreement, Gulf States and Petrate. It operated to realign the parties. It was announced after the discovery cutoff. We subpoenaed Deuces Tecum, the Gulf States representative, to obtain information about the Mary Carter agreement. The subpoena was quashed. We moved the court, this is all on January 2, 20 days before trial, and after the November 11 cutoff. We moved the court to allow us to reopen discovery. That was denied. We moved the court to strike the pleading that was late filed, which aligned and for the first time put Gulf States as a plaintiff. That was denied. We moved the court for a continuance. We moved the court to bar Gulf States' participation in the trial. Those motions were denied. Adams Vox had been prejudiced by the Mary Carter agreement. I can't say it any better than it was said in Judge Spears' opinion or in the Columbia Law Review, which we have provided the court in the appendix to paraphrase the opinion in Scurlock. This case has resulted in gamesmanship by attorneys. This case has resulted in colored testimony, and this case has resulted in a artificial finger pointing, and that has prejudiced Adam Spock.
Which of your points of error raised the complaint as to the public policy elements of the Mary Carter Agreement?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't tell you right offhand which of those are. I can assure the court that it's preserved. It was preserved. Okay. We specifically addressed the Mary Carter. The length of the argument at this point, I'm not certain.
And when we grant applications, typically the whole case is here. But we grant specifically on the 21st and 22nd points. I take it it's not raised by those points specifically.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. They're intertwined because the Mary Carter Agreement, and this is the last reason I suggest that the court must reverse this, the Mary Carter Agreement specifically provides that it is an indemnity, that they seek indemnity from Adam's Box by this. That's the very thing that this court in International Proteins and Beach Aircraft versus Jenkins has said you may not do. It is against public policy for a person who caused or participated in the cause of an injury to take an assignment of that very cause of action and prosecute it himself. That is the exception to the general rule that you may not that you may assign a cause of action.
Can you justify a public policy that allows Mary Carter agreements but disallows one party to purchase?
Yes, Your Honor. Cause of action those two cases, this court does not have to reach Mary Carter. This court can decide it on IPC and on Beach Jenkins. It specifically says you may not do that. This agreement goes further than a Mary Carter. Traditional Mary Carter, as I understand it, is a covenant not to sue between the plaintiff and one of the defendants, and perhaps some pecuniary relationship with respect to limits on recovery or something like that. This case does more than that. This case releases each party. It's not a covenant not to sue. It releases each. It says this is done to allow them to get indemnity from Adam's Box, which was addressed by this court specifically, and it goes on to say that, it just falls squarely within the principles announced in those two cases. For that reason, we ask the court, if the court does not find that as a matter of law, a credit exists in favor of Adam's Box as a result of the satisfaction of the $3.6 million claim that it asserted against both Gulf States and Adams, then the one half of the cause of action that remains by Petrade, as owned by Petrade, be remanded, and we determine what credit, if any, there the defendants would be entitled to. Are there any questions?
May it please the court. This is not a promissory estoppel case. This is not a promissory estoppel case, as the Court of Appeals has written. Promissory estoppel does not create a contract where none exists. The Court of Appeals has written, as a matter of law, there is unambiguous language, words in the writing that precludes its construction as a written as a contract as a matter of law. The Court of Appeals has written, the writing did not constitute a confirmation, and this contract is subject to the statute of frauds. What do we have? A mere offer. The writing itself, as analyzed by the Court of Appeals, is a mere offer. And as the master of that offer, and as the author of that writing, Pep Trade is bound by it. And as a matter of law, they are precluded from saying that the writing is anything but an offer. And as an offer, Adams and Box had the right to either accept or deny the code. The code said there must be, says there must be some writing sufficient to indicate that a contract of sale has been made. Past tense, has been made. This is an offer. An offer is not a contract. It is a writing that may become a contract if it is accepted. It will not become a contract if it is not accepted. Adams and Box did not sign this offer, and it never became a contract. Promissory estoppel does not create a contract where none exists. Four cases determine as the law in this promissory estoppel theory. Moorburger by this court in 1972. Bodie, a writ refused case in 1973. Nagel in 1982. And then the Fifth Circuit case, Great Western versus Lodestar Donut. In Bodie, a writ refused case. The writings must be complete within themselves in every material detail and must contain all the essential elements of a contract so that they may be ascertained from the writings without resort to parole testimony. Thus, we can only look to the writings for the essential elements of an alleged contract, the essential elements, and an offer does not contain all of the essential elements of a contract. Are there any questions?
How do you distinguish that from Penzoil against the Texas?
In what respect?
Well, there's no writing at all.
And the statute of fraud was not involved.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Can I the court? Mr. Larry Melka and Mr. Richard Wilson will present arguments to the respondent, which is a double order.
Honorable Mr. Chief Justice, other honorable justices, may it please the court, I'm Larry Veselk, and I'm here representing Gulf States Oil and Refining Company. And before I get into the substance of the issues that I want to present to the court today, I want to make sure that the court understands what's before you and what's not before you. In answer to Mr. Justice Heck's question, the points of error raised by Mr. Adams, which were never raised by Mr. Box, notwithstanding that they were in his outline of argument for today's argument, with regard to public policy of Mary Carter, were in points of error 17 through 20 in Mr. Adams' brief, which were not granted by this court and are not before this court.
You're wrong about that. Even though we granted on certain points, the whole case is before us.
We understand that the whole case is there, but we understand that you granted only those two points and not the others.
We can rule on the other points of error as well. We have jurisdiction of the whole case.
I appreciate that.
Help you with your argument.
Yes, sir. Now, the issues before this court involve more than the question of the credit, because which were the specific points from Mr. Adams, which we agree that the whole case is before the court. And I want to bring that up because while we're here as a respondent in the way the court asked us to argue, I'm also here as a petitioner. And we have presented our own points of error to this court because we, along with Petre, were the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. We were suing on two different contracts. One, a contract for 200,000 barrels of gasoline, for which we were seeking the damages provided under the UCC for that contract, or alternatively, for promissory estoppel to defeat the statute of frauds if we weren't under the merchant exception to the statute of frauds, or alternatively under the oral guarantee, all three of which we say entitle us to the UCC damages of contract price, market price differential for the gasoline contract. That was the amount that was entered by the trial court of some $2.8 million. In addition, we were seeking causes of action for the breach of the settlement agreement arising out of a separate contract, which was with regard to 100,000 barrels of what's called number two fuel. And that's an agreement made by Mr. Box on behalf of him and his partner, Mr. Adams, to have Mr. Adams pay $1.3 million in settlement. And there the court did enter judgment for the $1.3 million, but only as to Mr. Adams and not to Mr. Box. So we brought points of error before you saying that we should get the entire $2.8 million with regard to the gasoline and the $1.3 for the settlement agreement. The Court of Appeals reduced the judgment with regard to the gasoline from the $2.8 million to $409,000 because of, in our opinion, a misapplication of the Moorburger case and how promissory estoppel works when it's used to defeat a statute of fraud defense. So I want to briefly address some of the misstatements of the record that have been presented by the argument by petitioners here, and then move into those two points we would urge the court to consider, which would allow reinstatement of the $2.8 million against Mr. Box and Mr. Adams jointly and severally on the gas. First, on the misstatements. It's interesting how cases like this, this matter has gone on now 10 years, ultimately bring the truth out. Because whereas we had to go through a trial and we had to go through the Court of Appeals and fight and fight and fight over whether there was any contract that we're suing under, in the outline of arguments that have been submitted by Mr. Adams, we now have admissions. One, he admits, Adams acknowledges the deals with regard to the oral agreements. He says, down further down on his chronology, oral gasoline contracts with Adams repudiated at this time on July 2nd. He now admits they've repudiated the agreements which he's admit that he acknowledged. And he states further that Petrade and Box agreed to settle the two-oil. Remember, they're just settling the two-oil dispute, not the gasoline. And in that, Adams to pay $1.3 million. Those are now undisputed facts, as the jury found. The jury found oral contracts as to each of those. Now, with regard to the issue of the credit, Mr. Wilson will be addressing that point in his time, but I do want to point out the factual inaccuracies with the large chart you just saw, which we received earlier this week. I'll use from a smaller version. Y'all have it, in the handout they gave you. The first part, with regard to Petrade's cause of action in the middle, back against Gulf State, they refer to the injury of the $3.6 million. That's right, that was a conversion claim where they were trying to get back $3.6 million to pay it back. It lists as a recovery the release of Petrade's claim. It doesn't show that as part of that, Mr. Justice Heck, they also gave up their conversion claim. They released their claim. They also gave up 50% of their claim against Box and Adams. And they've had, as you said, no satisfaction at any time. They've received no dollars from anyone. So that discussion is incorrect. Further, on the portion about the Gulf State's claim against Petrade, he refers to, we were trying to give them credit for the $3.6 million. That's incorrect.
That's incorrect?
Yes, sir. Demand, we were suing on the gasoline contract. We were looking for the contract price, market price differential. He has attached to his outline, his appendix to the outline of his brief, Mr. Adams, the original petition, which comes from the transcript, which reads, we were offering an offset for 2.4, $2,425,000 in paragraph 8 of our complaint, because that was the value. We had delivered the oil, they had paid for it, then they asked us to take it back and deliver it to them in July. When time came for us to deliver it in July, we kept it as an offset to our losses on the gasoline. The value at that time is what we were willing to give them also, because that's when we were going to use it for something else, not the $3.6 million. It was a totally separate amount.
But you got the
$3.6 million. It was not involved.
But you got the $3.6 million.
We received it.
So where does that figure? You have a claim for breach of gasoline contracts for $4.4 million, for which, and you were offering the credit for the number two oil never delivered of $2.425 million.
So our lawsuit was actually claiming $1.9 million.
What's just the difference between
the 4.4 damages under the gasoline and the 2.4, which was the value of the two oil at the time we took it as an offset rather than delivering it to them. The market had dropped that much from when they had paid and made the original contract to when we delivered.
So what happened to the $3.6
million? $3.6 million had been paid and used to buy other operations of the company back when it was received in June as part of a normal delivery.
If the claims had been pursued and everybody had prevailed, Petrade and Gulf States had both prevailed on their own claims against one another, you would have recovered approximately $2 million against Petrade, and it would have recovered approximately $3.6 million against you.
Well, they couldn't have both happened, because for us to get the $2 million, we're saying we were entitled to the offset, so it couldn't have been a conversion. They're claiming they get the $3.6 million back as a conversion claim.
Well, was the credit that you gave for the value of an undelivered oil in addition to what you had already received in cash?
That is that credit rather than the cash that we gave in saying they still owe us $1.9 million on the gas.
Well, how can you keep the cash, the oil, and still sue for money?
Because they owed us more on the gasoline. They paid us at the time, and when we delivered in June, the original contract was June delivery. Time for delivery came, they paid us as they were required to do, and then said, deliver it later. And at that time, we have an obligation to deliver it, but we have damages on the gasoline contract, and when they cannot meet, prove the ability to answer to meet the $10 million it's going to take for them to pay for those lots of gasoline, we offset with the value of the oil.
So you gave them a credit for the value in lieu of what the cash was paid?
Yes.
All right.
Now, on the other side of this equation, it's all incorrect as well. Coming down on the side where Petrade is going against Gulf States, you see in the first, the breach of the contract to buy two oil, it shows as the injury of $3.6 million. Not true. The injury was the difference between the contract price and market price at the time of the repudiation. And that's what we were suing for, and for which we got a judgment from the trial court. On the second one, with regard to the breach of the settlement agreement, we were seeking that contract market price differential. We did not get a judgment by that, because instead we received the judgment on the settlement of the two oil, which is the next tier down. There, that injury is not the $3.6 million. There, the injury was the $1.3 million, which was promised to be paid and was never paid. So that's incorrect. Down on the gasoline, on the third level, where they show the lost profits, that's where we were seeking the contract market price differential. Then on promissory estoppel, they show the $3.6 million. That is one of the things. Court of Appeals also found, as the evidence showed, that Petrade had bought 100,000 barrels of the gasoline in reliance on the promise of Box and Adams to sign the writing. They had also missed the opportunity, relinquished the opportunity to sell that 200,000 barrels of gasoline in a falling market. They held on to it and didn't sell it to somebody else in reliance. So there were substantial reliance damages in addition to the $3.6 million. Now, turning to the issues of promissory estoppel and the statute of frauds. First, with regard to the promissory estoppel, the reasoning that Honorable Justice Campbell has raised is just completely certain. Completely certain. What we have in this writing is a case where, to confirm the contract, they sent a document that said, this confirms arrangements made. between the parties, including the price, quantity, quality, delivery time, and terms, and referred to it specifically as a confirmation. Court of Appeals, misapplying a Fifth Circuit decision, has said that can't be a confirmation, it can only be an offer, which I will address in just a moment. With regard to their argument now on promissory estoppel, they're saying that because it's an offer, they're picking out the language with regard to promissory estoppel that says it has to be sufficient under the statute of frauds itself. Well, of course it is. It was signed by Petro. The only thing it lacked was the signature by Adams. If Adams had signed it, it would have been a complete contract. If you're now going to say that you cannot use promissory estoppel unless the party has already signed a written contract, you're going to say that there is no promissory estoppel. You would never need to raise promissory estoppel if you can get there if you've already got the signed contract. You only have the promissory estoppel when they raise the statute of frauds as a defense. Now, in this case, I want to focus on the distinction between promissory estoppel as an affirmative case and promissory estoppel here, where it's used to defeat the statute of frauds. The Court of Appeals properly found that promissory estoppel, based on the jury findings, applied here. But rather than using that to defeat the statute of frauds, and therefore leaving you with an enforceable oral contract, which the jury found that there was an oral contract, and all the terms necessary to enforce that contract, as we believe is authorized under Section 139 of the Restatement Second of the Contract, which had been previously Comment F to Section 178, and which was discussed in Warburger and in the Rotama Manor case, which are in the brief, that those provide the opportunity for you to collect contract damages, which in this case would be the $2.8 million that the trial court put in. Here the Court of Appeals said, no, you can't get contract damages, you can only get reliance damages. I would like to cite to the court one additional case that wasn't in our brief on this point. It's a very recent case from Wisconsin. It's the U.S. Oil Company versus Midwest Auto Care, 440 Northwest 2nd, 825, Wisconsin Court of Appeals, 1989, which has a very good description of the policy for why you would apply promissory estoppel to defeat the statute of frauds, and says how this isn't a problem because an additional protection against abuse and inequity, I'm reading on page 828 and 829, says Wisconsin courts have long recognized the rule that equity may bar a defendant from invoking the statute of frauds. Equity will interfere to give one immunity from the consequences of the statute of frauds when the failure to interfere would be a fraud on the other party to the transaction. The statute of frauds was intended to prevent fraud and perjury, not to give one party or another a technical escape from a fair and definite agreement. When the elements of equitable estoppel are met, the equities of the situation take the statute out of the statute of frauds, and the contract is enforceable according to its terms. According to its terms, the jury found here an oral contract. The statute of frauds is blocked, is voided by the promissory estoppel, all elements found. In this instance, we should be able to collect the contract damages. That's what was allowed in the Rotama Manor case. That was what was reserved by this court to rule on in the Warburger case. The only case against it is the Magabar case, which was cited by them, which was dismissed by agreement. This court never got to rule on it, and showed in itself that it was focusing on the particular equities in that case, which we think distinguishes it. And the authority it relies on includes the Kenny v. Porter case, an NRE case from Corpus Christi in 1980, which specifically said where it did not find promissory estoppel. But where there is promissory estoppel, it would have specifically enforced a contract, which shows that contract damages are recoverable when the promissory estoppel voids the statute of frauds defense.
Mr. Sarka, you put absolutely no stock in your own language that reads, if this is in accord with your understanding, please sign and return one copy of this confirmation for our file. You read that out completely out of your document?
Mr. Justice Gonzalez, that issue goes to whether it can be a confirmation for purposes of the merchant's exception. With regard to the issue of promissory estoppel,
That was in there, and the testimony is, and the jury found, that they promised to sign that. And so, even with that language, as to promissory estoppel, once they would have found it, signed it, it would have been a complete contract. And so their promise to sign that brings it within the promissory estoppel to void the statute of fraud. And so we then should be able to enforce the underlying oral contract. There is nothing then to prevent enforcement of the oral contract. So we should get contract damages under the UCC for the oral contract.
But the Court of Appeals, however, said no.
Yes, because of, they're saying reliance damages. On the issue of that, the effect of that language, though, goes to whether it can be a confirmation for purposes of the merchant's exception under Section 2.201, I believe it is, of the UCC, and which I'd like to turn to right now, John. In the our first point of our, aside from promissory estoppel, voiding the statute of fraud so we get contract damages, that's one argument that would give us the full 2.8. In addition, if we fit under the merchant's exception, we get the full 2.8 because you don't have a statute of fraud there. The jury found the contract, found they were merchants, found we intended this to be a confirmation. The evidence was also clear that normally these things are done by telex. Mr. Adams did not have a telex, so they had to send him hard documents. They picked up language and they included that in there. Now, obviously, if you look to the comment of the purpose of the merchant's exception and the statute of frauds, the policy issue is to see, do you have something more than somebody saying, we had an agreement? To avoid perjury problems and the problems of whether you prove there was an agreement, the issue is to have some writing that gives you a basis for believing there is an agreement. This language, because it says, confirms, as I said, this confirms arrangements made between Mr. Stephen White and Mr. J.R. Adams concerning the transaction described below. And even where it's asking you to sign it, says, please sign and return one copy of this confirmation for our files. Somebody trying to get their paperwork cleaned up in that way, we don't believe should